Scott Ritter is back on the show today. Scott is the former UN Chief Weapons Inspector from 1991 to 1998, looking for the WMDs that weren't there in Iraq. He also served as the Ballistic Missile Advisor to General Norman Schwarzkopf during the Gulf War in 1991. He has been on this show many, many times, and I've said it before and I'll say it again. Everything Scott Ritter has ever said on this show has turned out to be true. Every single thing he has said on this show has turned out to be true. That's why you need to pay attention now as we talk about his new book, which is called Target Iran. Scott, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Always a pleasure. And as always, we do have the one caveat when Scott is on the show. If you hear the phone drop to the floor and he's not there anymore, it's not because something's gone horribly wrong in his house. It's because the fire alarm has gone off. He's a volunteer fireman. And if the siren goes, he goes. Right, Scott?
That is absolutely the case.
All right.
Hopefully, it's raining here. Looks like a quiet day, so we shouldn't have any problems.
I hope that's the case. All right, Target Iran is the book. You've traveled there. What's it like?
Well, I'll tell you what it's not like. It's not like what we see on TV. It's not like how mainstream media has portrayed it. You know, when you think about Iran and you look at the television, you're expecting this very oppressive police state full of bearded religious fanatics who run around and burn the American flag on every corner, shout death to America, women dressed in black and beaten and oppressed. It's the most progressive, modern, Western, pro-American country I've visited in the Middle East besides Israel. It was stunning just how open their society is. It's not perfect, yes. They shut down newspapers. You're not allowed to get on the street corner and speak out against the regime. But, for a brutal dictatorship, and I put that in quotations, everybody's got a cell phone, and they're all like text messaging each other. Dictatorships don't like cell phones. They've got satellite television, so they get to watch the BBC and CNN. Imagine that, the free flow of information.
Mm-hmm.
They have internet access. And like I said again, this is a very modern, westernized society that is surprisingly pro-America.
Now, it's interesting to hear that because we've had an embargo against them. It has been a unilateral embargo by the United States for several years and apparently not having much of an effect.
Well, it has an effect on some big ticket items. For instance, when you deal with military issues, when you deal with their nuclear energy program. I mean, a lot of people sit there and say, now, if the Iranians weren't up to any good, then why did they go to the black market? Well, they went to the black market because we impose an embargo that even though it's unilateral, given the global economy, basically, for instance, if Germany decided, Siemens Corporation decided they wanted to go in and build a nuclear reactor at Bushehr, if they did that, we would embargo Siemens. And so even though we're embargoing Iran, no one's allowed to do anything or else we embargo them. It affects their air industry. They have old aircraft. That's why they keep crashing. It affects, the big ticket. But, the day-to-day stuff, there's shopping malls there that would make Americans blush, full of, all the top fashions. They've got modern automobiles. They've got fantastic highways. I drive up and down the New York Thruway system. Their highways are as good or better than the New York Thruway system, up to and including the rest stops, with modern flushing toilets. Imagine that. So, we have an embargo, but America tends to forget that there's a whole world out there that does business, and they're doing business with Iran, and they're making a lot of money doing business with Iran. And as somebody who's part of a capitalistic society, I'd like to think that maybe because we believe in a free market, we might want to make some money in Iran.
All right. Now, the big threat from Iran that we're led to believe is the nuclear threat, that Ahmadinejad and his government want to get their hands on a working nuclear device, which they could then use against us, use against Israel, use against their other neighbors, give to other bad guys. These are the constant threats that we hear about what is going on in Iran. Aside from all the westernization that you're talking about, how serious is that threat, Scott?
It's not serious at all. I mean, there is a nuclear energy program inclusive of a uranium enrichment element that has the ability to be converted to a nuclear weapons program, because once you start enriching uranium for nuclear energy, it's the same technology that's used to enrich uranium to high levels for nuclear weapons. So, you know, and that's the problem. People are saying, oh my gosh, look, the Iranians can enrich uranium. They have a nuclear weapons program. They don't. Unlike the North Koreans, who stated that they have a nuclear weapons program and then said, you know what, we plan on popping off a test device and then did it. The Iranians have said, we don't have one. We have no intention of having one. We reject nuclear weapons. The Iranians condemned the North Koreans for their test. The bottom line is Iran is developing a nuclear energy program inclusive of the full fuel cycle that they initially declared in 1976 to the then Ford administration. This was during the time of the Shah, when they said, we have a finite amount of oil. You know, we've got to find alternative energy sources for domestic use so we can continue to sell oil down the road. We need a nuclear energy program, including the ability to enrich fuel so that we can't be held hostage by embargoes, sanctions, etc. The Ford administration said yes. Now, curiously, the chief of staff at the time was Dick Cheney, and the Secretary of Defense was Donald Rumsfeld. Now, both of those individuals today say the clearest evidence why the Iranian program is weapons-related is that Iran is awash in a sea of oil with no legitimate need for nuclear energy. I mean, they're contradicting themselves.
And wasn't Rumsfeld also affiliated or on the board of directors of the ABB, a firm that actually sold nuclear technology to Iran?
Yes, back in the 70s. That's absolutely correct. So, you know, again, what we see here is that reality and facts are not driving the Bush administration's policy position vis-a-vis Iran. It's fiction and ideology. And this is very dangerous because it's fiction and ideology that got us involved in the ongoing debacle that is Iraq today. And if we're not careful, fiction and ideology will get us into yet another quagmire called Iran.
Talking with Scott Ritter, his new book is Target Iran, here on the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX. Scott, how do we know what's going on inside the nuclear enrichment facilities? Does the IAEA have access?
Yes, they do. I mean, again, another fiction that's put out there is that the Iranians have kicked out the inspectors. The Iranians don't allow inspectors. There's IAEA inspectors in Iran right now. They're at the declared nuclear facilities. The Iranians have curtailed certain inspections, which fall under the auspices of what's called the additional protocol. These are inspections above and beyond that required by law that Iran voluntarily agreed to do if the international community respected Iran's legal rights under Article 4 of the Non-Proliferation Treaty to enrich uranium. But when the United States pressured Europe to back away from this commitment, the Iranians said, then there's no reason for us to let you continue to have this unprecedented access to, you know, our nation. You can still come in and monitor our nuclear program as is required by law, but we're not going to let you crawl around and look under every rock and under every sheet and in every toilet unless, of course, at the end of the day, you acknowledge that we have a right to enrich uranium. And the Iranians are willing to submit everything they do in the nuclear field to stringent nuclear inspections. And these inspectors are good. This isn't the Keystone Cops. These guys come in with the top-notch technology. If the Iranians are cheating, these guys will detect it.
Is Mohammad El-Baradei still the director general of the IAEA?
Yes, he is.
Have you spoken to him?
I have not. Not recently. I mean, I spoke to him back when I was a weapons inspector with the UN, but recently, no. You know, he's a Nobel Prize winner. He's operating on in rarefied air right now. It's tough to get a hold of him.
Yeah. Now, what he was saying about Iraq was very similar to what you were saying about Iraq, and unfortunately, it seemed to have been ignored. Is the same thing happening now in Iran?
Well, you know, it's curious that he's you understand that the inspectors, and this was true when I was a UN inspector, we operate on two planes. One is technical, one is political. Technically, Mohammed El-Baradei's inspectors have come out and said that while they cannot prove that Iran doesn't have a secret nuclear weapons program that they are unaware of, everything that they've done in their investigations shows that there is no nuclear weapons program, that there is no factually based data to sustain any allegation that Iran is pursuing a nuclear weapons program. The problem is, because he starts off by saying, we can't, you know, disprove all these allegations, when people say, well, they buried it underground. but they don't give you a location. They just say it's buried underground. Bardite, you know, he says, well, you know, we can't refute that. And you know, how do you move forward there? So now the political side takes advantage of that, and they've created a situation as they did with Iraq, where they say it's not up to the inspectors to find the hidden weapons. It's up to the Iraqis to prove they don't, or the Iranians to prove they don't exist. And so, and because Mohammed al-Baradei is an international civil servant, he cannot contradict the political findings of the Board of Governors, which is inclusive of the United States and other powers. But he has done some amazing things. For instance, with Iraq, he sat before the Security Council and told the international community that the United States fabricated intelligence about Iraq's nuclear program. And more recently, when Hoekstra and other American congressmen released a so-called intelligence estimate that said Iran is pursuing nuclear weapons and quoted from the International Atomic Energy Agency to back up their claims, Mohammed al-Baradei did, you know, an unprecedented thing. They publicly contradicted this estimate. They came out and said, no, gentlemen, you are misquoting us, misrepresenting our data. We say the exact opposite, that there is no evidence of a nuclear weapons program. So Mohammed al-Baradei is, you know, he's walking a very difficult political tightrope, but at the end of the day, you know, he's thrown out enough data there to reinforce everything I've said here, that there is no evidence to sustain any allegation that Iran is pursuing a nuclear weapons program.
Scott Ritter's brand new book is Target Iran. There's a link to it right now on my website, harrisonline.com. He wrote the book Iraq Confidential a year ago, and now this year for the month of October, he's out with a new book called Target Iran, The Truth About the White House's Plans for Regime Change. That's what you believe is in the works, Scott? You think we're getting ready to go into Iran?
Well, you know, I take the Bush administration at their word on this. It is the policy. It's the stated policy objective. They've articulated it in the National Security Strategy of the United States, the most recent version of which lists Iran 16 times as the number one threat to the United States of America. They have said that the goal and objective of the United States is regional transformation, where we remove rogue nations and failed states and replace them with, quote-unquote, viable democracies. You know, so it's not what I believe. It's what they're saying, and I just take them at face value.
Do you have information that we are preparing for war with Iran?
I have. Again, you know, I don't sit around the War Council anymore. I don't get the invitation to the White House.
Gee, I can't imagine why, Scott. I would think you'd be in those cabinet meetings in one of those back chairs, ask for your opinion all the time.
I know. I mean, or you know, I don't have the red phone that rings and they're like, "Hey, you know, we're getting ready to do something. What do you think?"
Yeah.
But I do know people who continue to have that kind of access, and while they will not divulge, you know, classified information, you know, every indication is that there is serious planning ongoing that goes far beyond that which is required for prudent contingency work.
All right, let's talk about the leadership of Iran. This guy Ahmadinejad, who was just at the UN a few weeks ago, he's a real saber rattler. He likes to spout off all sorts of words, particularly about the United States and about Israel, has essentially said that he wants to wipe Israel off the map. Why don't you think that that is what Iran is going to try to do?
Well, I think we need to differentiate between the words of an individual and the stated policies of a nation.
Yeah, but he's the president.
Well, that's true, but let's read the Iranian constitution for a second. He has no power. I mean, most Americans probably don't realize this, but, you know, he can sit there and say what he wants, and he can articulate, he can play to the street all he wants. But the bottom line is the power brokers in Iran reside not at the presidential palace, but at the home of the supreme leader, the Ayatollah Khamenei. There's a group of people called the Guardian Council. They have their fingers on the buttons when it comes to policing the Iranian state, the military, the nuclear program, and foreign policy. These are the people that count, and I therefore listen to them, not Ahmadinejad, because they're the ones making the decisions. And in 2003, it is this group that sent a letter to George W. Bush via the Swiss embassy and said, we want to normalize relations with the United States, we want to negotiate a peace treaty with Israel, and we're willing to put the nuclear program on the table. This was rejected by George W. Bush because our goal and objective as a nation is not to normalize relations that sustain and keep in power a theocracy. We want to get rid of these guys. And so we're the ones that rejected peace. We're the ones that kept in play the posturing domestically inside Iran that allows an Ahmadinejad to say what they do. Let's also keep in mind that the supreme leader has issued a fatwa or religious edict, and this is an Islamic nation. This is serious stuff that rejects nuclear weapons, and they have repeated this over and over and over again. I condemn Ahmadinejad's statements. They're irresponsible, they're inflammatory, and they definitely don't help the situation out. But I understand the reality of Iran, and I recognize that his words, while repulsive, do not reflect the genuine policy of those who count.
Well, and who is it in Iran who is helping fund Hezbollah and Hamas and some Shiite groups in Iraq?
Well, first of all, let's the Iranian government's doing it. Hezbollah. What is Hezbollah? Everybody's running around. It's a terrorist organization. Oh, my God. It's like they're a whole bunch of bearded fanatics who want to blow up the world. Hezbollah is derived from the legitimate expression of individual will of the people of southern Lebanon, the Shia, who responded after 3 years of Israeli invasion and occupation to form an organization dedicated to liberate South Lebanon. I don't condone their tactics. I don't condone some of their statements. But let's not get too far-fetched here when we say Hezbollah is out to threaten the world. Hezbollah is out to liberate South Lebanon.
Well, I think Hezbollah is out to threaten Israel, as they proved by throwing those missiles over the border earlier this year.
I mean, my God, they threw missiles over the border, but who destroyed who?
Well, that's the lesson that they learned, that you don't mess around with Israel by throwing...
Well, I think the lesson they learned is that they could defeat... I mean, one of the most dangerous things that came out of this most recent conflict is that Hezbollah stood toe-to-toe with the IDF and didn't get defeated.
Oh, I think they got beat up pretty good.
Well, I
in fact, didn't the leader of Hezbollah said, if we knew that they were going to respond with that kind of force, we never would have done that?
He was saying that if they knew Israel was going to bomb the entire infrastructure of Lebanon, they never would have done that. They have no problem standing toe-to-toe. I've listened to it. I've read his speeches, et cetera. They don't come off as a defeated group. They're sitting there thumping their chest. They have more political power in Lebanon today. They are able to leverage that. I'm not saying this is a good thing. What I'm saying is that because we have, I think, defined Hezbollah in unrealistic terms, because we view them as one thing when in fact they're another, we exacerbate the problem. Iran funds Hezbollah. This is not a secret. Iran arms Hezbollah. This is not a secret. But Hezbollah, while they are not buddy-buddy with Israel, is not an organization, for instance, like the Palestinian Liberation Organization or Hamas, that is pledged to drive all Israelis into the ocean. Hezbollah simply wants to make sure that Israel stops interfering with the internal affairs of Lebanon.
See, I see Hezbollah more as I would see a street gang like the Bloods or the Crips. They gain credibility from the people in their neighborhoods by helping them rebuild their houses and helping them with medical assistance and money when they need it, and yet they're still a bunch of thugs.
Well, I mean, we can talk semantics, but guess what? Who's not? Let's ask the question. Why is it Hezbollah that's rebuilding hospitals? Why isn't it a government?
Because Lebanon has an incredibly weak government. You talk about Ahmadinejad in Iraq having no power. These guys in Lebanon, in Beirut, have no power whatsoever over that part of the country.
My point, exactly, which means that these thugs have now become more legitimate in terms of governance than the government.
No, but that's like saying we don't need the cops there anymore because the street gangs take care of everybody.
But if there's no cops and the guardian angels are the ones coming out, if we don't like them, let's put cops in place.
All right, I'm not talking about the Guardian Angels. I see a difference between them and groups like the Bloods and the Crips. But you're right, we're now into semantics. Scott, last year there were reports in the Sunday Times of London that the Israelis had used a mock-up of Iran's Natanz uranium enrichment plant in the desert to practice destroying it. They kind of have some history of that going back to 1981 when they bombed a facility in Iraq. That was it pronounced Oserac? Is that how it was pronounced, the nuclear enrichment facility?
Oserac, Right?
Oserak, yeah. So my question to you is, if Iran did move towards uranium enrichment for the purposes of a weapon rather than for just nuclear energy, what are the implications of that?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting question because, you know, there's a lot of people that say, look, you know, Iran has every right to develop nuclear weapons. You know, they're like North Korea trying to develop them as a deterrent to America. I take a different standpoint. You know, the Iranians have come out and have put their national prestige behind the notion that they aren't pursuing nuclear weapons. They claim to be, you know, law-abiding members of the international community, and all they want to do is carry out a program which is permitted under international law. And I defend that fully. If it turns out that this is their front and they're actually pursuing a nuclear weapons program, I'm one of those people that says, you know, I have to believe that there's ill intent there.
Yeah.
Because if I, you know, let's remember this about North Korea. They withdrew from the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and then they tested their device. North Korea obeyed the law. We may not be happy with it. We may not like what they're doing, but they haven't broken any law. They actually did what the law says they're supposed to do.
But breaking the law and coming up with a threat are two different things, and the question is, how do you respond to a threat? And my real question is, what happens if Israel decides that it is going to respond to a perceived threat in Iran by going and bombing those nuclear facilities as they did in Iraq some 25 years ago?
Well, first of all, let's just make it clear. Israel has a responsibility for Israel's national security, and Israel's a tiny little country that has zero margin of error when it comes to other nations using nuclear weapons on them. And so their level of concern is, you know, orders of magnitude greater than, for instance, our levels of concern would be. And I would be surprised if Israel isn't preparing to take decisive military action to do that which it deems to be in its national interest. But what I need to caution people is that what's good for Israel is not necessarily good for the United States. And in this case, unless we have hard, factually based data to sustain and to prove that Iran is developing nuclear weapons, a military strike, either by Israel or by the United States, I think is going to cause much more harm than good, because Iran is not a defeated nation that's going to roll over and go gently into that good night. They have the ability to leverage their oil economy in a manner which is not only going to hurt the United States, but hurt the global economy, inclusive of Israel. They have the ability to project military power through long-range missiles so that Israeli cities are once again subjected to bombardment. And they have the ability to sustain this for months, if not years. So this is not a problem that would be resolved quickly. That's why I would caution the Israelis, and I have cautioned them whenever I can, to be patient on this one, because you know, nuclear weapons programs are not something that is easily hidden. And in the case of Iran, we have unprecedented access on the part of UN weapons inspectors who can gain access to the facilities in question, do the testing, do the inspections, and if Iran is trying to divert and build something in secret, I have a high degree of confidence that it will be discovered well in advance of any such program reaching fruition. Keep in mind, with North Korea, with limited access, we knew a lot about their program. You just can't keep this stuff secret.
In your book, you've got a map, and it shows, by my count, 10 different nuclear facilities in Iran. We have access to all of those? By we, I mean the international community?
Absolutely, and we have access to even more than the ones that are listed. But also, the interesting thing to point out is you're counting 10. Let's say there's 15 that are of interest. And yet, when you talk to military planners, we're talking about 1,000 impact points in our bombing campaign. If there's only 15 nuclear sites, what else are we bombing? And that leads me to ask, what's the reason for the bombing campaign? Is it about nullifying the Iranian nuclear program, or is there something else at play here? And I think that there's something else at play, which also then begs the question, why don't we just say that's what we want to do then, right up front? Look, we don't care about this nuclear program. We're just out to get rid of the regime. I think we're doing a bait and switch here, the same way we bait and switch the American public on Iraq. where we claimed the WMD capability to exist. And remember all the rhetoric that came out about Dick Cheney saying they've reconstituted their nuclear weapons program. We heard talk about secret facilities underground, the buried facilities that turned out never to exist. What we got was regime change that turned into a disaster. I see the same parallel. I see this, the parallels taking place in Iran today. That's why I'm someone who's insistent on fact. If you're going to tell me there's a threat coming out of Iran, back it up with more than speculation and rhetoric.
Only got a minute left here, Scott, so let me finish up by asking you what the U.S. intelligence agencies are saying about Iran. Not the IAEA, but the U.S. intelligence agencies, the NSA and the CIA. And is their information being spun as we think it may have been done before we went to war with Iraq?
Well, the bottom line conclusions from the CIA and the DIA is that there is no evidence that Iran's pursuing a nuclear weapons program. Then they caveat it by saying that it's possible that Iran could divert material that's not being detected and have a program that no one knows about. And then what happens is that caveat then gets picked up by John Negroponte, who is the politicized head of intelligence, and he'll say that Iran is 5 to 10 years away from a bomb. I always love that number when I hear it, 5 to 10 years. But when you don't have any evidence of a program existing to begin with, how can they be 5 to 10 years away? And yes, so the short answer is I see the intelligence data being cherry-picked and being misinterpreted and misrepresented by senior elements of the intelligence community who are more ideologically aligned with the Bush administration. But at the end of the day, as was the case in Iraq, you have the real analysts on the ground sitting there scratching their heads saying, hey, we don't see that picture.
Scott, as I said when we started this conversation, everything you've ever said to me on the radio has turned out to be true. So I'm taking your word on everything you've said here today, and I will send my listeners to the bookstores and to the online websites to buy a copy of Target Iran and find out more about all of this from you directly. I thank you, as always, for your time, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you, sir.
Scott Ritter here on the Paul Harris Show. It's News Talk 1120 KMOX.